We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning. No job again this week. He's still traveling, but we expect him back next week, right?
Well, that's what he told us. Whether that turns out to be true or not is another matter entirely. Right. All right. Well, let's start with local, and who is Paul Jackson Jr.?
Well, good question. Remember, people will remember the lousy response to the snowstorms by the city of Seattle back in December. And it turns out that the city had dumped the responsibility for managing their response to the snowstorms on the street maintenance director, and that man's name is Paul Jackson Jr. Well, the Seattle Times has been looking into some documents from the city. One of the documents they requested was the investigation of problems within his department. And what they found is that after the city did a $500,000 investigation into problems of discrimination and favoritism within the street maintenance department, that they had found problems with Paul Jackson Jr.'s management style, that he was dictatorial, unfair, even unsafe was one of the words that was used in the report in relation to Jackson. And what did they do about it? Did they fire him? No, they promoted him into a job that has no defined duties yet and in which he is receiving a $108,000 a year salary. This is at a time when the city is undergoing major cuts and cutting a lot of the city, a lot of very important city programs. And so, you know, it kind of begs the question of, okay, is our mayor really competent himself, having hired and promoted? Not just the mayor, I want to say also the head of the city department of transportation, Grace Krunican, is she also competent? Because, you know, they promoted this guy into a job he had no experience for, and then when there were problems in the department, they didn't do anything, and then after spending $500,000 to investigate problems in the department, they promoted the guy. That's just, you know, it smacks of favoritism all through the city, not just in the street maintenance department, and it also says something about the competence of our higher ups in the city, both the mayor and the head of the Department of Transportation.
All right. Well, news this week on Lieutenant Aaron Watada.
Yeah, some good news. Lieutenant Aaron Watada, who refused in 2006 to deploy to Iraq with his brigade out of Fort Lewis. He had been court-martialed in 2007, but the court-martial ended in a mistrial. And then in order to stop a second court-martial, his attorney sued in U.S. District Court, claiming that a second court-martial would represent double jeopardy, which is prohibited under the U.S. Constitution. In October of last year, a U.S. District Court judge ruled in Watada's favor that, yes, a second court-martial would be double jeopardy. And now this week, the Department of Justice under the Obama administration said, why are we prosecuting this guy? And they dropped the case against him. So that's some good news for Lieutenant Watada. He's not completely in the clear. He can still be tried by the U.S. Army on two counts of conduct unbecoming an officer for a couple of interviews that he gave in 2006 where he expressed his personal opinion of George W. Bush and his foreign policy. Still, Watada has got some good news this week.
All right. Starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a very strong local movement for troops that want to resist deployment to Iraq and folks that are having trouble in the military right now. You had a couple of those folks on the show earlier this morning.
Yeah,
didn't you?
Seth Manzel and Andrew Vandenberg, both with GI Voice and Coffee Strong, and they're having an event today at 12 o'clock starting at Coffee Strong.
Which and is where is Coffee Strong?
It is down in Lakewood. It's actually at exit 122 at 15109 Union Avenue Southwest in Lakewood, right next to the Subway shop there. So that's an event that's going to be starting at noontime at the coffee shop, and then they'll be going over to the exit, the overpass there, and protesting against the stop-loss campaign that's military stop-loss, where the soldiers from Fort Lewis will be shipping out in the next several months. But
yeah, so I starting very soon. Encourage people to go check it out. Just check out the coffee house if you're not interested in the protest. You know, go down and see what's going on down there. It's a great, great movement happening.
But the protest actually should be good as well. It's supposed to go all day. They're going to have events after it as well.
Excellent.
So, all right. Moving on, the Bellevue considering a tunnel.
Yes.
I've heard about the success with ours.
Downtown Bellevue wants a transit tunnel. Why, you might ask? You know, I guess it's because downtown Seattle has one, right? So why shouldn't downtown Bellevue have one? Well, if you remember last fall when we all voted on the light rail expansion plan, the cost of that light rail expansion plan that would, you know, would put light rail across the lake to Bellevue and then to points north and south of there, that expansion plan included costs for a street level or elevated light rail. It didn't include costs for a tunnel, which would add a minimum of $600 million. Practically, it really makes no difference. A surface version of the light rail line would only add about 2 minutes to the travel time versus having a tunnel with no stop lights and no crosstown traffic. There are two ways a tunnel could be built. They could do a cut-and-cover tunnel, which would kill a lot of the downtown business in Bellevue, just like it did a lot of the downtown business in Seattle, especially the small businesses along 3rd Avenue, which were simply just driven out of business by the cut-and-cover, by the years-long construction. It would also destroy a very popular downtown bus center, which was recently built for $26 million. That would have to be torn up and taken out in order to do the cut-and-cover tunnel. And, of course, a bored tunnel, the other way that they could build a tunnel, is highly favored by the Bellevue Downtown Business Association, which is no surprise. But it has its drawbacks, too. I mean, the $600 million cost, that is simply laughable. I don't think you can even call it a lowball estimate. It's just kind of a number they pulled out of the air with no support for it. I cannot believe that $600 million would be enough to build a bored tunnel through downtown Bellevue. And, of course, the recession means that the $18 billion that were approved for the light rail expansion budget might not be there when we need it. We could be short as much as $2 billion of that because of not enough sales tax income coming in, you know, not enough people out there shopping, et cetera. So, Where they're going to get extra money for a tunnel, I don't know. And then, of course, there's the little problem of sinkholes. We got some news this week that the current tunnel being drilled under Beacon Hill for the light rail line has opened up 7 underground voids that we know of. Those so-called,
I heard it was more. I thought it was more. But
yeah,
anyway.
Those so-called underground voids are what cause enormous sinkholes. It turns out that when the boring machine hits pockets of sand, that the sand gets sucked out and leaves these big voids that can then cause the sinkholes. It's also really hard to tell exactly how big and exactly how far those voids go, though they're trying to use this expensive equipment to figure it out. So far, it's cost about $1 million to trace and fill those 7 sinkholes with concrete. Those are the sinkholes that we know of. And, of course, the only way to avoid causing sinkholes in the first place is to slow down the drilling. Can you say delay and cost overrun? Because that's what we're looking at here. We're looking at either major problems with causing these sinkholes or major delays and cost overruns. So that's the other problem involved with drilling a tunnel, particularly through the deep bore method. Anyway.
Oh. Luckily, the big tunnel they want to put downtown on the waterfront, I'm sure there's no sand down there.
Oh, yeah. No, there are pockets of sand there as well. I mean, it's a waterfront. Come on.
Right. No, being sarcastic. All right, moving on. One more time talking about our mayor and one of his competitors for that title.
Oh, yeah. The Seattle mayor's race is turning out to be all about money, of course. Greg Nichols has been far and away the guy who has raised the most money. He's raised some $300,000 or more because he just raised another big chunk in April. And then it turns out one of his competitors, Joe Malahan, the T-Mobile executive who has filed to run in the race, he just wrote a personal check to his campaign for $200,000. Must be nice to be your own personal banker like that. That has just put him and Greg Nichols far and away the top two candidates who will be able to get the message out for this coming election. Meanwhile, Jan Drago is exploring the possibility of running for mayor. I guess she figures that her experience with dog parks is enough to get her the top job. I don't know. But
well, that was one of the questions.
That was one of the questions in her poll. She did a poll this week, and one of the questions is, would you be more likely to vote for Jan if you knew she'd helped you get off-leash areas in the parks?
Take the leash off the dog. All right.
Yeah.
Let's move on to national and this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week the government released the results of their bank stress tests, and of course they definitely didn't leave the banks or their executives in any kind of overwhelming stress positions. The tests clearly were designed to boost the markets, to boost the stock markets, because when they were announced as a confidence-building measure. And, of course, as the results came in, the Obama administration leaked them out slowly over time so that they wouldn't be this big surprise or this big shock that, oh, Bank of America needs to raise, you know, $34 billion extra in capital, et cetera, et cetera. What was interesting, there were a couple of things that were very interesting in the way the results were released. Early results leaked said that Citigroup, this kind of concerned me, that Citigroup would need to raise an additional $50 billion or more. But then when the official results were released, Citigroup, it turns out, only needs to raise some $5 billion. And looking at that difference, it just kind of pointed up to me that the rumors that banks had been heavily lobbying the Fed and the Treasury to change the results of the tests may have had some impact. So I'm looking at that going, man, those Citigroup lobbyists, boy, they're hot stuff if they can get a factor of 10 shaved off the results of these bank stress tests, you know? I just found that pretty amazing. But I also should point out, too, that this week more and more people are saying that the tests themselves were meaningless. For example, economists have predicted that official unemployment will reach or exceed 10% by the end of this year. That's pretty much accepted now, given that yesterday the Labor Department said that unemployment hit 8.9%. In April, we're almost at 9% now. You know, we will easily reach 10% by the end of the year. But under the worst case scenario of the stress test, they predicted a 10.3% unemployment rate not to hit until 2010. In addition, some banks are already reporting larger commercial real estate loan losses than the worst case scenario in the stress test. So clearly the stress tests themselves are not very stressful at all and were pretty much designed to be a very low hurdle that most banks could easily make it over. So given that, we should remember that the real problem here is not the capitalization of the banks. The real problem is the toxic assets on their books and the fact that what's underlying those toxic assets is a very, very weak housing market, and that the Obama administration has yet to come up with a real plan to address foreclosures and problems in the housing market.
So did toxic assets figure into the stress test at all?
That's a good question. I mean, they tried to figure out how much of those loans on the bank's books, how much of those assets were, they didn't really try to value the assets. They tried to figure out how much of the loans on their books would default. And as it is, like I just said, you know, commercial loan defaults for many banks are already above that amount that were figured in the worst case scenario. So my guess is that no, they really didn't look at the toxic assets. They just haven't addressed that issue yet.
And the banks that were included in this stress test, those were just the large ones that had gotten?
Those were the largest banks, many of which have received government bailout money. Mostly the 19 to 21 largest banks in the country. Some of the regional banks, as I talked about a couple weeks ago, that the stress tests might be penalizing the regional banks because they were putting most of their weight on loans that are kept on the books by these companies, not loans that have been packaged as mortgage-backed securities or these risky investments that banks have made. They didn't really look at those. They're looking at loans that they made directly and kept on the books. Regional banks tend to do that more than these big Wall Street banks have done. And so the stress tests have penalized the regional banks much more than the big players. But still, the stress tests themselves are largely meaningless anyway. So I just want to point that up to people, that if you're going to go out and buy financial industry company stock based on these stress tests, I wouldn't do it. Or if you're going to go out and go, oh, everything's rosy and everything, I don't have to worry about, you know, I can go ahead and overextend on my credit card again. I can buy a new home and take out an adjustable rate mortgage. Don't do it. Don't do it, because we're not in the clear by any means.
And yet the real estate industry is pushing hard with their commercials on TV saying, hey, it's good to go out and buy a house.
Buy now.
You'll be happy.
Buy now, because we have lots of risky financial products that you can take advantage of. And you know, there's no law in place to prevent banks from continuing to issue those risky financial products.
All right. Other economic news.
Yeah, the New York Federal Reserve Chairman, Stephen Friedman, this week resigned because a Wall Street Journal article was released revealing that he owned shares in Goldman Sachs, which in September became a bank holding company instead of a private financial institution. And once a company becomes a bank or a bank holding company, then the Federal Reserve banks become a major regulator for those banks, and it becomes a conflict of interest for anyone sitting on one of the Federal Reserve banks to own stock in that company. It turns out that Friedman is a former employee. In fact, he ran Goldman Sachs for several years. He was a former chairman of Goldman Sachs for several years. He owns a lot of stock in that bank, and in September, instead of selling that stock, he held on to it and then requested a waiver from the Fed, saying, please give me a waiver so I can continue to be chairman of the New York Federal Reserve and own this stock. And not only did he do that, in December, he went ahead, before he got the waiver, he went ahead and bought more Goldman Sachs stock. And then once he got the waiver, the day after, he bought yet another big lot of Goldman Sachs stock. This is very clearly a conflict of interest, and it's not kosher. So he was definitely forced to resign this week. And you look at that and you go, how many other of these guys sitting on the boards of these Federal Reserve banks are in the same position, and we just don't know because no investigative reporter has dug through their stuff yet, like they did with Friedman.
Well, and the Federal Reserve doesn't appear to be an overly open entity to begin with in terms of doing FOIA requests.
Yeah, it's quasi public, which means it's sort of public and it's sort of not. It's also privately held as well. And when you look at the guys who sit on the board of these Federal Reserve banks, the majority of them are appointed by their local business communities, which you might say is a conflict of interest already, particularly the New York Fed, which regulates a lot of these big Wall Street firms because they're registered as New York companies. They have a lot of these big banks have a lot of say in who gets appointed to the New York Federal Reserve Board. That, you might argue, is a conflict of interest. Three of the members of the board, which is a minority, are appointed by the Federal Reserve Bank itself. So, you know, the Congress and the Obama administration, they're looking at this going, you know, that seems to me to not be a great position for these guys, you know, who are regulators, to be appointed by the companies that they're regulating. Maybe we ought to change the structure and the management of these banks. And I'd have to say yes, yes, and yes, you need to do that, and you need to do that as soon as possible. Of course, we'll see. You know, we're still looking at hoping that Congress will do some kind of regulation of the financial industry. They haven't yet.
Yeah, and when they propose change, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be good change.
That's true. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be for the better.
Just plop themselves onto the boards. All right. More economic news. There were some auctions this week.
Oh, yeah. The Treasury auction this week. The government, because the U.S. government is trying to help bail us out of the economic problems by spending more money and running up a deficit, the government has to borrow money in order to pay its bills, just like everybody else does. And to do that, the government auctions off what are called treasury bonds to private investors to buy. And that's the way the government borrows money. big companies can borrow money by issuing bonds as well. The government does it through treasury bonds. And they had an auction this week of their long-term 30-year treasury bonds. There was a little problem, though, in that there apparently weren't enough buyers. So that the price of the bonds had to go lower than what the government had wanted to set them at. And when the price of the bonds fall lower, it means the government has to offer higher interest payments on those bonds to attract buyers. Well, that means that the government's it's kind of like saying, well, in order to get a loan, my credit isn't so good. In order to get a loan, I have to pay higher interest. That's essentially what's happening to the government because nobody really wants to buy government debt. They have to offer higher interest rates to get takers. Well, there's a problem with that. The interest rate for long-term treasuries has an impact on interest rates that are charged throughout the economy. For things like credit cards and commercial debt, et cetera, which is why the Federal Reserve has stepped in. Not only is the Federal Reserve printing a lot of money to get us out of the economic crisis, they also stepped in a few weeks ago and said that they would start buying up long-term treasuries to try to keep long-term treasury bonds to try to keep interest rates low. Well, the fact that they didn't have enough buyers in spite of the fact that the Fed is buying up long-term treasuries is a very, very ominous sign. It means that countries that have normally stepped in and eagerly bought up our long-term treasuries, like China and Japan, are either pulling back or they're simply holding pat. They're continuing to buy about the same amount rather than stepping up and helping us out. And there are several reasons why they're not going to step up and buy more. You can't really blame them. I mean, we have a total lack of transparency in our financial system right now. The stress tests were obviously a joke. They're clearly not happy that the U.S. government is doing zero to regulate its financial system, which we've been talking about for weeks now on the show, and that it's also not likely that the U.S. government is going to do much about the housing crisis anytime soon. So these are very important factors that make buying U.S. treasuries extremely risky for foreign countries like China and Japan now. I guess they're also probably tired of seeing the value of their investment in U.S. government debt be eroded by the issuance of huge numbers of treasuries and, you know, the price fluctuating as much as it has been. So that's an ominous sign right now. We've talked about that in the past, that if the government can't find takers for U.S. treasuries and interest rates go up, that could spark inflation. And if there's anything that will kill a nascent recovery, it's inflation.
And the Fed printing more money to turn around and then buy more treasury bills doesn't really work for the long haul.
No, it doesn't work for the long haul. And in addition, both the Federal Reserve and the Treasury have not been forthcoming in explaining to investors and to the public what they're going to do when the first signs of inflation start. How are they going to pull that cash back out of the system? They haven't really given us a detailed plan yet. They haven't told us how that's going to work.
I think it'll work like it did in Iraq, where they're just going to pile the money onto pallets and then fly off somewhere.
So, fly it off somewhere, yeah. Put it in storage, burn it, whatever.
All right, we're going to move on to international and developments, starting with Afghanistan.
Yeah, in Afghanistan, we saw probably the worst, the highest civilian casualty toll yet from a U.S. bombing run, up to 147 people killed in a U.S. aerial bombing raid in two villages in western Afghanistan on Monday. The U.S. planes were responding to a call from Afghan security forces and from Marines who were under fire from Taliban troops. And they were called in. It appears, I'm not exactly clear on this, but it appears that the bombings were done at night, and that probably added to a lot of the confusion and the fact that over 17 houses were destroyed in these two villages, that women and children were killed, that immediately after the bombing run, some 30 bodies were piled onto a truck and taken to the office of the governor of Farah. This really shows you the frustration that ordinary Afghanis are experiencing over the U.S. and Afghan government's attempts to minimize casualties when this happens. The fact that they would load bodies onto a big truck and haul them to the governor's office and say, look, you know, we don't want the media to say only three people died. Look, you know, there, here's 30 bodies, and it's a small number of the people who were actually killed, you know. And, of course, how did the U.S. respond to this? Well, through denial. Immediately they said, oh, no, it was the Taliban who did the deed. They threw some grenades into a few houses and are parading the bodies around. Well, when it became clear that local government officials in Farah had denied that and said, no, no, and, you know, Afghan security forces said, no, no, it was U.S. planes. Well, then the U.S. military had to say, well, I guess it wasn't that. It was Taliban troops. We killed a lot of the Taliban. They were most of the dead. Well, when the Red Cross stepped forward and said, no, we were on the site and we saw that they were mostly women and children. They were definitely civilians. Now the U.S. military is trying to say, well, they died because the Taliban made them stay in their homes while we bombed them. That's the excuse. That's patently ridiculous, and it is completely absurd. And clearly the U.S. needs to do something in order to change the nature of the conflict, most particularly end the bombing runs and try to figure out a way to deal with the situation without engaging in these kinds of acts, these kinds of atrocities.
And Hamid Karzai was in D.C. this week.
Yeah, he came to Washington, D.C. this week as part of his reelection campaign. Apparently, he's as unpopular here in D.C. as he is at home, so he's desperately trying to drum up support. The presidential elections in Afghanistan are in full swing. There are at least 18 candidates who have registered for the August 20th election. Karzai is the front runner, of course, even though his popularity is pretty low at home. He has persuaded his main opponent, Gul Aga Shirzai, to pull out of the race by promising to back him in the next election in 2014. So he's a wily guy, Hamid Karzai. Even though he lost his vice presidential running mate to Shirzai, he has appointed a new one this week, Mohammad Qasim Fahim, who is a warlord and was a former commander of Jamiat-e-Islami. That's a militia that was accused by human rights groups of gross human rights abuses during Afghanistan's civil war in the 1990s. That was the civil war that happened after the Soviets pulled out of Afghanistan and before the Taliban came to power. And that's probably true of most of the warlords in power in Afghanistan today. Of course, we should remind you that most of those warlords were put back into power by the U.S.-led invasion force into Afghanistan. So we can keep an eye on the Afghan election. Karzai's the front runner, and he has firmly allied himself with these former warlords.
Well, also in D.C. this week was the president of Pakistan.
Yeah, and he's also trying to drum up some support from the U.S. government, trying to whitewash his image a little bit, because the Pakistani army this week set off to fight the Taliban in Swat Valley again for the third time in the past year and a half. It's in response to the Taliban seizing control of the main town in the Swat Valley and moving closer to Pakistan's nuclear infrastructure, as well as closer to the main supply route to U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Pakistan is, instead of sending ground troops into the Swat Valley to really engage the Taliban, they're engaging in their own form of human rights abuses, which is aerial what appear to be carpet bombing raids that, according to the Red Cross, have displaced 500,000 people recently from the Swat Valley, which I'm sure is not drumming up much support for the Pakistani government or for the U.S. in the hearts and minds of the Pakistani people.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State in bookstores, coffee shops, and cafes around town. We can also be found online at www.eatthestate.org. And we are still doing our fundraising drive. I want to just point out that to get opinion like this in town in print form, you can't find it in the Seattle Times. You can't find it in the Weekly. You can't find it in the Stranger. You can only find it at Eat the State. And if you value that, you should go online and click on our donate button and give a little bit where you think it's needed. And we definitely need it.